Counsel, were you all present when I explained to Chief Justice O'Connor's absence and that she will be watching? Right, the next case on our calendar this morning is 10-670, Sutton versus or Tomco Machining Company versus Sutton, I guess is the proper order. For the appellant, Mr. Hollingsworth.
Good morning, Madam Chief Justice, members of the court. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for purposes of this argument. And as the court knows, it is the position of Tomco that Bickers, in particular the syllabus in Bickers, controls the outcome of this case, and that the Second District Court of Appeals got it wrong, and we're asking that you reverse the Second District in this matter. I want to begin by answering what I believe are two critical questions about the applicability of Bickers to this particular case. Did this court intend to limit Bickers to only non-retaliatory discharge cases? I submit the answer is no. Nowhere in your syllabus does it indicate that the rule of law set forth therein is limited to non-retaliatory discharge cases. And you have said on many occasions and adopted a rule that says if there is disharmony between your syllabus and the text or the footnotes, the syllabus controls. The second question that I would submit, which helps to answer this issue and resolves the matter in favor of Tomco, is does the syllabus in Bickers as written apply to this case?
Well, Counsel, the syllabus is just one part of the case. We have moved away from the syllabus controlling these matters. I want to ask you, in this case, they're alleging that when Mr. Sutton was injured, he went to his employer and said, "I was just injured lifting something," and was fired on the spot. And I assume that at this point that they are the claim, or what we're talking about here, is a pleading that it was a retaliatory discharge because he would be having a claim to file, but he was filed before he couldn't. It would have been impossible to make a claim before he was fired. And that the argument is we have a statute that gives some remedies to someone who is filed because they've made a workers' comp claim. But here, the unique facts of this case are that he couldn't, he would have been and did file a claim, but doesn't get the protection of that statute because he got fired before he could put himself in a position to get that. Do I have the facts basically correct as to what's alleged?
That's my understanding as to what's alleged.
Okay, and it is your position, the four elements that are articulated in the case that you want to rely on, that Justice Cupp laid out, are that there's clear public policy existed was manifested by a state or federal constitution or statute, or regulation of or in the common law. And here there is a statute. You don't dispute. There's a statute that provides some remedies for one who is fired for making a claim. Right?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Okay. Dismissing employees under circumstances like those involved in the plaintiff's dismissal would jeopardize the public policy. And it would do that, would it not?
Your Honor, I would say the answer is no. And here's why. In this context, as the court knows, this case arises out of an allegation that Mr. Sutton asserted rights under the Workers' Compensation Act, thus the source of the policy that's the subject of this case. This court has said on numerous occasions that the policy which underlies the Workers' Compensation Act is a policy choice made by the legislature, and that this court has taken a position.
I understand that. The policy was if you do a retaliatory firing, that's what's expressed in the statute, there are remedies, an exception to the common law employment at will.
The statute prescribes remedies because the legislature intended that it was only going to prescribe retaliatory discharges that may involve the filing of a claim and then the termination subsequent thereto or in the
So because he didn't have time to file the claim before he was fired, it can't be a retaliatory discharge. Is that your argument?
My position would be that when the legislature adopted 412390, it indicated that there were certain conditions under which retaliation would be prescribed.
Right.
And those conditions involved the filing of a claim and then subsequent termination or pre-claim activities such as pursuit of a claim, overt action taken by the injured employee that would put the employer on notice. I submit that in the act itself, the legislature intended to address the due process issue by making sure that the employee had taken some action that would put the employer on notice before the employer would be at risk for possible liability.
Now, I realize that we were a long way off from a factual proof that the firing was in retaliation for coming in saying I was injured. They've got to prove that. But let's assume he can prove that. You're still saying that there's no public policy, and you're saying he's your client's got clean hands because telling him I just got injured at work doesn't put you into the protection of the public policy of the statute.
Now, this court has determined a long time ago that expressing an intent to pursue a claim is not sufficient to bring an employee within the ambit of 412390. So if that's the simple set of facts and expressed intent, then I would say no, that there's
Well, then
no
why wouldn't every employer be instructed if somebody comes in and says they were injured or they can't even make it in? You know, they're laying out there on the floor when the squad picks them up on the factory floor and hauls them to the hospital because of an industrial injury. Why not tell the employer, just fire them on the spot?
As tough a fact pattern as that is, Your Honor, I believe the legislature, when it made the policy decisions about what would and would not be prescribed under 412390, I believe they took that into consideration. As you know, this is a delicate balance between the rights of employees and employers. It dates back to the early 20th century.
I'm sorry. The legislature clear. Your argument is that the legislature meant to protect injured workers as long as they filed before the term, like a race to the employer.
No.
So we mean to protect you as long as you get your filing in before the employer can walk down the hall and fire you, either on the gurney, in the hospital, or as soon as you report the injury.
No, it's not necessarily a race to the Industrial Commission. As much as it is a protection of the whole purpose behind the act was to make sure that injured workers would get the compensation that they would be entitled to. The purpose behind the act wasn't to tell the employers that they couldn't exercise their rights with respect to employment at will. If they chose to terminate an employee, I'm not saying that that would be the smartest time to terminate an employee under circumstances where someone is lying on the floor injured or in the gurney being transported to the hospital. What I am saying is that this whole issue of policy decision and choices you've decided a long time ago was in the hands of the legislature.
But your analysis would undercut the entire workers' compensation scheme. because to Justice Pfeiffer's point, every employer would simply fire the employee prior to them, as soon as they receive notification of any injury, they would simply terminate the employee. There would be no workers' comp scheme in this state if your proposition is accepted.
Not true. This court has decided a long time ago that if there's a statutory remedy that already exists, there's no reason to create some public policy exception.
Okay, I want to go to that argument. Statutory remedy is you can't retaliatorily fire somebody. You can't fire them if they file workers' comp. If we were to interpret that statute to mean that firing them before they file it fits in the category of retaliation, there seems to be some arguments in the brief that that option is no longer available in this case. Can you explain to me procedurally why not? If that was our solution, you don't create a separate common law tort because of our case law, but the statute applies in the Mr. Sutton has the ability to go back and file under the statute. Is that procedurally cut off somehow? Because that's what I got the impression of from the briefs. What's the statute? What's the status procedurally, if that was our resolution?
If you were to adopt the position that we're articulating?
No, if I were to say, okay, public policy, common law claims not available, but statutory remedy is he still entitled to that statutory remedy, or are you saying procedurally he's lost it somehow?
Statutory remedy is still available to him if he can meet the conditions under which the statute requires.
That if is what's bothering me.
Yes.
In this case, what can he meet those conditions, or is there something you're going to assert that says he can't even apply under the statute?
Well, in this case, he applied and received benefits. Those are the facts of the case. And so he was not denied those benefits, which is what the Act entitled him to. My argument would not prevent this person who was injured on the job and terminated before he or she could file a claim from filing a claim.
No,
and
no,
getting
no, that's
benefits.
Not my question. He's filed a claim. He's now gotten award under the claim. Your company fired him before he could file it. If we hold that that is retaliatory, even though it's done before, it's still retaliatory. If it's under the statute, does he have a cause of action under the statute? Because you're saying no public policy. He has the statutory remedy, but it doesn't apply. What defenses would you be asserting to his statutory retaliatory action?
Well, if he's recovered under the statute and you give him a common law cause of action, he could bring suit like on any other tort.
No. The opposite. We find there's no public policy common law right.
Yes.
But the statute, this qualifies as retaliatory. So under the statute, if you pre-fire somebody who's filing a claim, it's the same as retaliation after you file it. Can he go back and make a claim under the statute, or are you procedurally saying he's barred from that because of something he did not do or did not prove?
His remedies under the statute are limited to simply the compensation. If you establish a cause of action under the statute, arguably he could seek reinstatement and back pay, equitable remedies.
And if he were to file under that, what would your defenses be?
To the equitable, about the termination?
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't have any, because if he establishes the basis under the statute, then he would be entitled to those benefits.
So under 412390, it says no employer shall discharge, demote, reassign, or take punitive action against an employee because the employee filed or instituted or pursued under the workers' compensation for an injury which occurred during the course of employment. So the issue then would be whether or not the termination was as a result of the injury, and that would be litigated under the statute. Would that be a recovery in addition to the workers' compensation benefits paid for the injuries through the workers' comp?
If you allowed the common law cause of action, or simply under the statute?
Under the statute.
No.
Why would that not be available under the statute?
Because at the time the General Assembly created the Act and the statute, the goal was to provide the lost compensation to the injured employee.
Yes.
The goal wasn't to guarantee employment. And it seems to me that some of the questions might suggest that somehow the employee should be guaranteed a job simply because that employee was injured on the job.
But if the employee is injured and has remedies under workers' compensation to compensate for the injuries and whatever loss there might have been as a result of the injury, but is also terminated, why can that employee not under 412390 claim that my termination was related to the fact that I filed that workers' compensation claim and recovered under it?
Could file a claim, cause of action under 412390.
That's what I'm asking.
Yes, could do that.
I thought you said he could not.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I was mistaken if I said that. Your Honor, I am way over the 10-minute limit, and I asked to reserve 5 minutes, but I'll continue to take questions.
Well, if you're done.
You can reserve your time.
Yeah. You've got about 10 seconds left out of your 15. We'll give you at least a minute.
Okay. What I was going to say is that—
I thought you wanted to use that in rebuttal.
I will.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Silverstein.
Madam Chief Justice O'Connor, members of the court, may it please the court. I am accompanied by Jason Matthews, with whom I consulted on the brief. In pragmatic terms, the very narrow issue in this case is, can an employee be preemptively discharged by an employer who, within 1 hour of reporting his injury, so as to prevent that employee from availing himself of the protections of 412-90 or the other provisions contained in Chapter 4123. We believe that this case has broad implications, and so far we believe that the court, through its questions, recognizes the absurdity of the position presented by the employer.
Counsel, how does preemptive firing prevent a worker from filing for workers' compensation?
It doesn't prevent it from filing for workers' compensation.
How does it deter them from doing it? Actually, gives them more incentive to do it if they're terminated. They certainly want to collect their workers' compensation. So how does the policy of the anti-retaliation statute apply in this case when, in fact, discharge would not prevent or deter a person from filing for workers' compensation?
Well, as part of the compromise under the workers' comp statute, Your Honor, there has to be some mechanism to protect individuals who do file, and that policy is reflected in a 90 claim. However, our position is in this case that he had not even instituted a claim, and therefore we're really outside the scope of Bickers and actually outside the scope of 412390.
But in fact, his termination did not prevent him from filing a claim.
Didn't prevent him from firing the claim, but it did eviscerate any potential position that he had concerning raising a claim for retaliation. Our position is that this was a retaliatory discharge. Unfortunately, or I don't know that it's a question of unfortunately, in this case, looking at this court's decisions in Bryant versus Dayton Casket, the Roseboro case, and articulated in the Pinkerton case from the Court of Appeals, if he did not institute or pursue his claim, then we're not talking about a 90 retaliation complaint. So we really believe that we're in the universe of public policy because this is not a 90 claim at all. And we look at the language in Pinkerton, which interpreted the Bryant and the Roseboro cases. And in Pinkerton, the court said, we consider all the evidence, such as he had told his employer that he was injured on the job. We have that he notified his employer of his intention to file a claim as to a particular injury. We don't have that. And requested the paperwork so as to file his claim. So two of those elements articulated by Pinkerton based upon their interpretation of Bryant and Roseboro do not apply here. So because he did not institute or pursue a claim, all he did was tell the employer that he was injured, he notified the employee of his injury, then he's not within the scope of the retaliation protections, and that requires a separate look at 41-2390 in order to complete the analysis that we're looking for.
Does that require the legislature then to add an element to 41-2390, which is what I think Mr. Hollingsworth was trying to argue to us, that the General Assembly has not provided in 41-2390 the condition for an employer who discharges an individual who's been injured but who has not filed such a claim, because the listing says you may not discharge, demote, reassign, or take action against an employee because he has filed a claim or instituted, pursued, or testified in a proceeding under workers' compensation. And those, as you point out, don't seem to cover this situation.
That's exactly right.
So is this something that you should be talking to the General Assembly about, changing the statute to incorporate this?
I think even the appellant raises the question of inclusio unius est exclusio alterius, if I got that right, meaning if the legislature had not articulated that, not to say that they couldn't make an alteration of that in an appropriate legislative manner, but we don't have that here. So our position is that if you look at the express language of that statute, Mr. Sutton doesn't fall in there because of the preemptive activities of the employer in this case. And we think that that really opens up an entire can of worms and, as I would intend to argue here, also creates a chilling effect for employees to even bring these concerns to the attention of their employer.
Because once again, more retaliation for being injured, that's what it seems like, doesn't it? You're injured, you're fired. I mean, that's basically the facts that we have. No reason for it other than it didn't have anything to do with your job performance. Is Mr. Sutton eligible for unemployment compensation for the discharge?
Not during the time that he is disabled. Our position has always been in representing clients that once he is released by his physician and he is then ready, willing, and able to go to work, then he could argue that he is then entitled to unemployment compensation because the employer has not articulated any just cause for his termination. So the unemployment question could come up once he's released from his physician and is able to go back to work.
Well, counsel, the 90, if he Justice Stratton's questions seem to suggest the idea of saying this fact pattern we could hold brings it within the reaches of 90. 90 gives your client more than just workers' comp, doesn't it?
Exactly. It gives him protection from retaliation.
And those protections, in other words, the recovery could be what?
The recovery would be, and I'll be truthful with the court, I've had very few 90 cases even in my career, and I'm not a workers' comp attorney.
All right.
I believe that he can get his back pay, he can get reinstatement, but he can't get any damages for the retaliation.
Okay,
for the
understood. But it's something more than getting workers' comp.
Right.
It's more than getting workers'
yes.
comp, but our position is that that is not a satisfactory remedy for an employer to take this sort of preemptive action.
What kind of benefit does the employer – benefit, I guess, is the – loosely use that term, or maybe advantage, or for an employer to terminate an employee because they're injured even before they filed for workers' compensation, what accrues to the employer for that? They don't avoid the employee filing for workers' compensation. They don't avoid that going on their the way they calculate the experience rating for workers' compensation. What benefit or value to the employer is there to terminate somebody just because they've been injured?
Well, I think
I'm a little puzzled by that.
Well, I think that 41-2390 articulates that policy in order to maintain the balance that's inherent in the compromise that we're talking about in the creation of the workers' comp statute. If you didn't give the employee some protection for retaliation from
No. I'm not talking about retaliation under the statute. I'm talking about the preemptive firing, as you call it. What benefit is that to an employer?
I think, first of all, broadly, it sends a message to all other employees that I think it presents a chilling effect. Now, with regard to any particular employee, maybe there's no benefit to the
What the effect is, don't get injured on the job or you're
fired?
Or
don't report the injury, Your Honor. No. You know, to prevent employees from reporting at all, I think that this is going to create a very strong inhibition for employees to even bring this to the attention of the employer and to bring it to the attention of the employer promptly. They might wait until after the fact. You know, if an employee has a back injury, as Mr. Sutton did in this case, he might wait to report it. But in this case, he was one of the first employees in. This is not necessarily part of the record. The employer was there at the time because Mr. Sutton was a maintenance manager. And it really sends a message and does benefit the employer in being able to terminate the employee in retaliation even before he files, because then I think you chill that, and I think it discourages any other filings by employees. And thus, you have to look at the broader public policy that's articulated in 412390.
Okay, let me take you back to the retaliatory statute. If Mr. Sutton had not been fired and had filed his worker comp and then had been terminated, and you could prove it was in retaliation, does not our case law limit it to the statutory remedy? There's no separate public policy common law right to sue.
Absolutely, Your Honor.
Okay.
We agree with that.
So the problem I'm struggling with is we have this gap. If we find that the statute actually covers situations, and we find the language of the statute is written such that firing them before they get a chance to file it actually covers it, the public policy, if statutory remedy is available, then Mr. Sutton is put on the same footing as someone who's retaliated against, correct?
Yes.
If, however, we find there's a gap and you have a public policy claim for damages, then you are going to probably allege you could get punitives.
Punitives and additional compensatory damages.
So now he is in a better position than someone who falls under the statute for retaliation. He has a recovery that is greater than the statute. And so I'm struggling with the public, if that is what you're asking for. I mean, I'm more comfortable saying the statute covers him, it's a level playing field, rather than us as a court making a public policy decision that this gap gets greater recovery than if they fired him after he had filed the worker comp. Do you see where I'm going with that?
I do understand that, Your Honor. And
that takes me into the legislative arena and the balancing act. So now you've got a different balancing, a different recovery.
We agree that you've changed the balance. But what you have done is, if this court permits the public policy exception to the employment at will rule, what you have done is discouraged employers from preemptively firing. So it's the employer that makes that determination.
And if we do the same thing if we just say the statute actually covers him.
Not entirely, because if an employer takes such an egregious and retaliatory action in this case, then it's the employer that sets up that type of claim. What we're asking this court to do is to recognize that if an employer acts so egregiously, and we believe that the determination whether it's retaliation must either be determined to be within the statute or outside of the statute, and the legislative intent the legislature clearly identifies what constitutes a filing that would put somebody under the authority of 412390.
Now you're arguing what Mr. Hollingsworth is arguing, and I'm where Justice Stratton is. I don't honestly think that the legislature thought that employers would move to do this race before the filing. They meant to protect injured workers. So why could we not find that 90 applies to Mr. Sutton and put him in the same position as someone who'd been fired after filing a workers' comp complaint? You're trying to stretch it to cover more when I initially thought what you wanted was for workers to be protected, your client specifically. Am I incorrect in that?
Let me think about your question. I think that what we're saying is the whole purpose of the statute is to discourage employers from firing employees after they institute or pursue a charge. However, in this case, Mr. Sutton did not institute or pursue a charge prior to his termination. So you have the employer who is in a position, in the superior position, of terminating and creating that tort, when in fact, if you do that, if you create this public policy exception, if you recognize this public policy exception, you will discourage employers from this preemptive action rather than discouraging employees from pursuing or reporting an injury.
But if we cover them under 90, employees will not be discouraged because they have the protection that's otherwise available. Isn't that correct?
Then I think you're expanding the legislative language, the specific legislative language under 412390.
Although, Mr. Silverstein, we could say instead of if we interpreted that we're talking about no retaliation after they are injured instead of after the filing is made, that seems to be less of a problem than saying we would have to overrule Bickers and affirm what the trial court or what the Court of Appeals did here. Do you agree with that?
I still disagree with that, because under the current situation, and you have to go back to look at the compromise, which is to give some balance in terms of the rights of employers against the rights of employees and to equalize what is inherently a disparity. The legislature recognizes that. However, this court has already said, I believe, in order to determine that even a pre-filing or even before pursuing or instituting, that falls under 90. I think you have to change Bickers. I think you have to overrule the decisions in Bryant and Roseboro.
Why would we change Bickers? In Bickers, we said that an employee who's terminated from employment while receiving workers' compensation benefits has no common law action, and exclusive remedy is the statutory under 90.
Bickers was a non-retaliatory filing, though.
The fact would be, if you expanded Bickers to incorporate those who were eligible to file, it would eliminate a common law cause of action but have a statutory cause of action, would you not?
I guess you can do that, but the only mechanism that we can see for you to be able to do that without upsetting the balance, without having to overrule all of these previous decisions to bring them in line with this very unique situation that the employer himself created, we think cannot be done other than recognizing a tort.
Counsel, there's been a discussion of overruling Bickers. To resolve this in the fashion that you're urging, is recognize this fits into the definition of a common law remedy, doesn't require us to modify Bickers at all, does it?
Not at all. In fact, our position is that based upon the language of the statute and the protections in Bickers, or at least the reading of Bickers, it really doesn't apply, it would be appropriate for this court to uphold that public policy, go through the four analyses of a public policy that wouldn't upset Bickers, it wouldn't upset Bryant, it wouldn't upset Roseboro. There are plenty of other situations where there are statutes that create a public policy that this court has recognized.
Counsel, in this case, if we were to do what you ask and the Court of Appeals did, what do you have to prove to recover? Do you have to prove anything more than the mere fact that there was an injury and there was a termination?
Well, first of all, if this court would allow the public policy exception, and I'd say I'm past my time, let me address
the question.
Your Honor's question. Yeah. I think you go back to the four elements of a public policy claim, and if I can just address those briefly in this fact situation. First of all, you need clarity, and the clarity we take from 412390, which recognizes the legislative intent to protect employees.
That's a legal question, though, right? Clarity?
Sure.
All right. What do you have to prove if we would recognize the public policy exception? Do you have to prove more than the fact of injury and the termination?
We would have to prove a nexus or the fact, which would be a jury question, whether the discharge was motivated by the reporting of the injury. Now, the employer would then have a right under the fourth element of a public policy claim to establish that there was some overriding justification, that there was some.
You don't have to prove that the discharge was motivated by the employer's concern that the worker would file for workers' compensation?
I think that it would apply not only to that worker, but to any other worker. I think that it's not going to stop the employer from it's not going to stop the employee from applying for the workers' compensation.
So
but
if you don't. You just have to prove then that I'm trying to get at what the parameters of this. What I heard you say is then you just simply have to prove the fact of injury, the fact of termination, and then the jury gets to decide whether the discharge was retaliation for the injury.
Exactly right.
But not retaliation because the employee wouldn't be entitled to workers' compensation for the injury, and that's why the employee or the employer
That's a different situation than what 90 identifies.
Essentially creating, it's not a little narrow, this is pretty big, right?
But I think
it really is any time an employer terminates an employee when they're injured, either before they've indicated they're going to apply for workers' compensation or on the tail end after they have, you're going to have this retaliation question because the one before is going to be hard to distinguish from the one after, as was the situation in Vickers.
Except that we believe that 412390 doesn't include the preemptive retaliation. And if you allow that preemptive retaliation, then the absurd result would be that the employer would fire somebody right away once they have notice of the injury. And we believe
that. Well, I understand, but you're claiming you don't even have to prove a connection between workers' compensation and the reason for the termination, just the mere fact of injury, and that's a pretty broad cause of action.
I think you have those broad analyses in every type of in every type of public policy retaliation claim that you have. I mean, I think that's where you go with these. But again, I think you have to send a message to employers. If the goal is to encourage an employee to report the injury, and the employer under the current status has the right to preemptively terminate that employee, you're going to upset that balance.
Counsel, we're way over time, but you said you're not a workers' comp lawyer. Isn't the right answer, and you alluded to that to some extent, is the employer can produce all of the other reasons. And your client could have been this was the tipping point. He was ready to fire him anyway because of lousy work habits, absenteeism, a whole bunch of other things.
Correct.
And this was just the last straw, and he blew his stack, and it was unfortunate of the timing, but there were a whole lot of other reasons, which I would guess would be the case an awful lot.
Well, we're here under a 12B motion,
yes.
So we really haven't
right.
We haven't established that record at all.
We understand that.
So we're stuck.
But the employer would have the full opportunity to say there were a whole lot of other things going on here that motivated my decision.
But again, I guess the question is where the motivation is, or where the discouragement is.
All right.
Your
time's up.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you. Mr. Hollingsworth, you've reserved 10 seconds, but we'll give you another minute or two. But we're pushing ourselves here in terms of we've got three more cases and the admission of lawyers to do yet this morning. So
fair enough. Thank you, Your Honor. I'll try to speak quickly. The fundamental problem with recognizing the common law cause of action that Mr. Sutton is asking you to recognize is that you will create a significant amount of litigation where none existed, and more importantly, where when the general
assembly. Well, now that wouldn't be right. The employers would create the litigation by firing in the fashion that your employer
No, I would suggest the anomaly exists in that the employee could then start to manipulate the entire workers' compensation system. It's not simply a matter of the employer taking an action to end the employment relationship.
The employee, by coming in saying, I got injured, manipulates the employer into firing him on the spot.
I've been injured, doesn't file a claim, takes no action. Say it's 2 weeks later, say it's a month later, say it's 6 months later, employer terminates him. That employee now has a cause of action under this principle that's being recommended where it didn't exist before, which is where now the manipulation.
I don't know many smart lawyers that would take that fact situation. I'm not
suggesting that smart lawyers would. I'm
well,
saying
let me
saying
pursue the thing that Justice Stratton opened is – do you object to this court looking at this fact pattern and any fact pattern that might be remotely similar and saying, we believe that comes within the clutches of 90 and this gentleman should have all of the rights, not just the workers' compensation claim, and payment under the comp law, but have the rights under 90 for back pay or reinstatement or any of the rights that the statute gives. Do you believe that that would be a reasonable interpretation of what ought to flow from this case?
It is an interpretation. Part of the potential problem is that it's already been determined that he has no statutory claim. So if you find that it comes within the ambit of 90, you would essentially have to also say that he now you've reinstated his 412390 statutory claim. That, I think, would be a potential problem.
Procedurally.
And the reason is that the trial court said he has a common law action, and so they didn't really reach the statutory claim because they said, well, they talked about it a little bit, and they pined about it, but they said we don't really have to go there because you've got the other claim.
The Court of Appeals reached that conclusion. The trial court throughout the entire case.
And was a relief under 90 sought at the trial court level?
Yes. There were two claims made, one under the statute and the other alleged a public policy common law cause of action. The trial court threw out both. The Court of Appeals affirmed the statutory dismissal but reversed on the common law issue. The common law question is the one before you.
Right, our equity, I mean, if we decide the statutory still existed, the Court of Appeals really didn't get to the statutory because you didn't need it. If you had a public policy, you didn't need the statute anymore, so it's kind of a little twisted in terms of procedure.
Yeah.
So we could reverse and remand to the Court of Appeals to consider the statutory claim.
You certainly could. I would certainly argue that would not be appropriate thing to do here. The biggest concern is that what we're going to do is we're going to create litigation in the workers' compensation arena, where the whole purpose behind the act and the system itself is to provide benefits and minimize, if not eliminate, litigation.
Mr. Hollingsworth, would you rather see this under 412390 or as a common law action?
If you leave me with two choices, I would take the former, not the latter. I tend to believe that if there is to be a common law cause of action, that's in the jurisdiction of the legislature. It's a matter that should be taken up by the General Assembly, not this court.
But the legislature's already done that. They've created a scheme to protect workers, and then we got a smart employer that said, oh, we have a window. Let's terminate before they have a chance to file, which completely undermines the workers' comp system and puts the employee in the choice of, do I get benefits while I'm injured or do I keep my job?
It has certainly been my position that the statute covers a guy like Mr. Sutton, regardless of his allegation that he hadn't filed a claim or hadn't taken any overt action to institute or pursue a claim. That's my position.
You mean the statute? You mean 90? 412390
yes,
covers
yes.
this situation.
Yes. If there is a gap, if you think there is a gap, the gap should be addressed by the entity that created the policy, which you've deferred to historically.
But you've argued just before, just in response to Justice Lansinger's question, reversing and remanding for the appellate court to consider 90 would not be what you would recommend.
She gave me two choices, Justice O'Donnell, and I picked the one that was most preferable.
Sir, aren't you talking about the workers' comp benefits, and we're also talking about retaliation?
Yes.
The two separate things that we're talking about here.
Yes, but the 412390 talks in terms of prescribing retaliatory action on the part of the employer, but it's motivated by an injured employee who is seeking benefits. An employer is trying to deny that person the benefits. Here, he got his benefits. There's nothing
but lost his job.
But retaliation is the second point.
An employment at will relationship, there is no indication that the fact that he lost his job had anything to do with the fact that he pursued benefits because he hadn't even filed
He'd
a claim.
He'd only been injured an hour. He didn't have time, to go pursue the claim.
And that's an excellent point because it raises the other point that I would make. If you create this common law cause of action, what period of time must pass between the alleged injury and the adverse employment action? And for sure you'll talk in terms of reasonableness. That's fact specific. We'll be litigating these cases.
Thank you, Mr. Hollingsworth.
Thank you.
We will take a brief recess and be back. We have three more cases and the admission of lawyers yet this morning. Thank you.
All right.